This week on the Best of Flashpoints, Oakland Institute Director Anuradha Mittal talks about the global food crisis, African farmers, and the so-called Green Revolution. Our special correspondent Kevin Pina, just back from Haiti, dissects current U.S. policy there and the ongoing struggle for human rights in an increasingly repressive situation. Also, Catherine Austin Fitz talks about the world's most powerful investment bank, the so-called vampire squid, and the year in review for community business. And Sam Husseini talks about the Cairo protests against Israeli apartheid and the failure of mainstream media to cover the unraveling situation in occupied Palestine. All this straight ahead on this week's Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Anuradha Mittal is a native of India. She is internationally renowned now. She's an expert on trade, development, human rights, and agriculture issues. She was named by The Nation magazine, yes, this is true, as the 2008 most valuable progressive thinker. And she is deeply valued by this program and a friend of mine. Anuradha, it's been a long time. Welcome back.
Thank you so much, Dennis. Pleasure to be here.
Well, it's good to have you with us. And there's a lot that's been happening around food and politics. There's a lot being said about the Green Revolution. And there's a lot of people being forgotten as we get green. So let us begin maybe with the big climate summit. There was a lot of ballyhoo. There were a lot of people there. But the people on the earth who suffered from the devastation of the First World didn't really have much to say. They didn't have a part in this, did they?
Well,
except
Dennis,
in the street.
Dennis, I think you've said it really, really well. Copenhagen, which had generated so much attention, a lot of resources went into it. People traveled from, faraway distances to have their voices heard. It is really unfortunate that this moment was once again missed when the rich nations who are responsible for the environmental destruction that we see, which has resulted in devastation around the world, which, as you said, is being faced by the poor nations and the poor who live in those nations, they did not see real movement, real commitments. And the change that we were waiting for from the Obama administration, we did not see that as well. So while some might believe that the talks were saved thanks to President Obama, we haven't seen real commitments. We haven't seen true, genuine political will to deal with this big crisis, which is no longer a theory, but is in our faces.
No, and I want to tell people, I was so excited to see you, I forgot to tell them where you're from. You're the founder of the Oakland Institute. Oh my God, what am I thinking about? And first you were working with Food First, and now at the Institute, you have really devoted your work to food and politics and food as a human right. So I want people to know about that. We're going to tell them more about an event that's being sponsored by the Oakland Institute in a moment. But now, what's the, we hear a lot about this, the carbon trading. It's almost all we hear about, and it really is the three card monte of global trade, isn't it?
Well, true. I mean, the problem is that people do not want to deal with the structural factors, do not want to deal with the true causes of, say, climate change. So we are looking for these band-aid solutions. For instance, rich countries can continue to pollute. The rich can continue to live lifestyles that they do not want to change, and they're living those lifestyles at the expense of the others. So we come up with these solutions which are not even halfway through alternatives, and rather than deal with the true solutions that are on the ground. So for instance, in Copenhagen, we're talking about climate change, but agriculture was not really talked about. I mean, I mention agriculture because agriculture, the way we do it right now, industrial agriculture, is one of the leading contributors of greenhouse gas emissions. In addition to that, methane and other things also released from the way we do agriculture. So instead of really looking at agriculture and saying we need to do it differently, we need to look at sustainable agriculture, which would also also be good for the small farmers who form the bulk of the poor in the world, it was not even being discussed. So we keep promoting development patterns. We keep promoting a paradigm of development which would cater to the interests and needs of the rich corporations instead of dealing with the crisis that we have on our hands.
What does, let's deal with some of these terms that are thrown around. What does climate justice mean to you?
I'm glad you asked that question, Dennis. The whole idea of climate justice is rooted in the fact that what's happening to our environment, the cost of that, the impact of that, is going to be borne by all of us. However, the first people to bear the cost of that, as I said before, are the poor. So when you think of, say, Katrina, who suffered from Katrina the most? When we think of tsunami, who was most impacted by the tsunami in Asia? It is the poor fisher folk. It's the poor small farmers who were anyway having a very hard time meeting their livelihoods. So the fact that it is not just an environmental issue, but it is also a justice issue, that the calamities of nature, that wrath is worst faced by the poor, that is really an issue of justice. Or when we look at it, the cost is borne most by the poor developing countries who have not been the main contributors. Even if you think about China and India, compared to what US has done, we cannot compare. There's whole asymmetry about the contribution to this environmental disaster. And that's why we talk about justice. So climate justice is about having protocols, having saving the environment, which caters to the needs of everyone, especially the poor.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we are talking about food justice and all the things that revolve around real human rights, the ultimate human right, which is to be able to eat and survive. We're talking about that with Anurata Mittal, the Oakland Institute. And I'm looking at one of the little booklets that you put out, and this one's called Voices from Africa. And the subtitle here is African Farmers and Environmentalists Speak Out Against a New Green Revolution in Africa. Now, it's a little counterintuitive. Why are these farmers speaking out against our green revolution?
Well, the green revolution that we are talking about in our report, Voices, is really the term that is used, for instance, by the Gates Foundation. And they're talking about hunger being just a crisis of demand and supply. So if we increase supplies, say, through their new green revolution, which is chemical-based agriculture along with genetically modified crops, so it is called the whole new green revolution, which is nothing else but a euphemism, a PR strategy. And we are challenging that because our partners on the ground, as this report shows, farmers, environmentalists, activists, are challenging their threat to food sovereignty. And also the way the whole hunger crisis is being framed. Since we were talking about climate change, let me also say, while we are not talking about how we do agriculture, GM crops have been offered as a solution for climate change, that they are going to be environmentally beneficial. And it is very important to challenge this PR strategy, this greenwashing and poor washing. And that's what this report does, to really showcase what people in Africa want. They definitely don't want a white prescription, you know, that has come from Seattle for the whole black continent.
Well, and I want to follow up on the genetic, the idea. I mean, a lot of talk about nuclear energy and genetic farming, which is really counter to the whole system of agriculture in Africa. Could you talk about what GM means to traditional African farming and where that conflict takes us?
Well, you know, despite a lot of talk that we hear around GM crops, we can make nutrient-rich crops or make crops that are resistant to droughts. The crops that are currently grown commercially are none of those crops. You know, we're still waiting for the golden rice, the vitamin A rice, or drought-resistant cassava. All of those crops have failed. So we know that there's a technology that has not delivered. It has been, at most, a PR strategy, as I said before, a poor washing, greenwashing strategy. strategy. And the crops that we have are the ones where the likes of Monsanto have made a killing by selling seeds. They have taken over the seeds. Most of the crops that are grown are basically Roundup ready crops. That means you can pour as much Roundup, that is, by the way, sold by Monsanto. It is one of their products. So you buy the seed from Monsanto, and it is a seed of a crop that you can pour in as much herbicides, Roundup, and it will still not be killed while everything else around it would die. By the way, Roundup ready crops are registered as a pesticide. So it is very interesting that we talk about climate change, saving environment, but the product is listed as a pesticide, and that is being promoted in the world. At the same time, this model of agriculture is based on large farms, large industrial farms, monocultures. When you look at Africa, more than 90% of the farmers are small farmers. They do not have the resources to buy these seeds, to sign these contracts with Monsanto, then have resources to buy these herbicides and pesticides. So what we're really doing is promoting a model of agriculture which would benefit less than 1% of the population of these farmers, and in fact would put them on this chemical treadmill. And if you look at what's happened in my country, India, farmers have been put on this debt treadmill, and they only get off by taking their own lives. So it's a recipe for disaster that is being promoted by the likes of Jeffrey Sachs and Gates Foundation and the rest.
Well, what do you mean they only get off by taking their own lives? Is this a problem now?
Well, Dennis, the unfortunate reality in my country is, which is acknowledged by the government of India, that between 1998 and 2008, over 180,000 farmers have taken their own lives. These are farmers who were promised the miracles of cash crops, they were promised the miracles of genetically modified seeds, who have spent far more resources in buying these seeds, because unlike the previous seeds, they cost a lot more, then they fail, then you have to buy pesticides, and when you're taking more and more loans. And let me tell you that only 27% of those loans are from the governments. The rest of the loans had come from private loan sharks. So when they cannot pay back those loans, they have taken their own lives. And it is not something that has just been made up by the Oakland Institute. This figure is agreed upon by the government of India. And if you actually look at the figures, you're talking about a farmer every 30 minutes in India taking his own life. So we need to stop this treadmill. Instead, we are seeing that this same treadmill is being now promoted in Africa as a new green revolution.
It's really shocking. And this is a way also for these corporations to really control the future of food and food security or insecurity. I mean, you talk about real food security. This is sort of a system that's built against the possibility of self-sustainability, of people having control over their own resources.
Dennis, the current food system that we have is totally upside down and backwards. You know, instead of farmers being the stewards of the land, they have been replaced by the machines. Instead of the small farms, we have the large industrial farms. Instead of biodiversity, you have monocultures. And we are calling it successful way of feeding the world. We are talking about investment in agriculture, where we are seeing in developing countries, farmers are losing their access and control over natural resources such as land, water, and seeds. With the food crisis, with over 1 billion people now going hungry, according to the Food and Agriculture. Over 1 billion people, one-sixth of humanity.
Is going hungry.
Is now identified as going to bed hungry by the FAO. Of course, these people are in the developing world. Instead of giving people land, we are seeing foreign direct investment, which is leading to land grabs. So you have countries and private investors buying up land in poor countries such as Pakistan, Vietnam, in African nations. So when you're taking away those resources, people are left with no land, no resources to feed their own populations or their families and communities. Then you have the likes of Monsanto move in, also take over seeds. More than 1 billion farmers around the world save their own seeds. But those rights are being written away as our biodiversity is being destroyed, and Monsanto is the one who's going to provide you your seeds.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Anuradha Mittal. You can understand why she is a very important alternative thinker in the world of food and food security. Let's talk a little bit about 10 years after Seattle. Remind people in a nutshell, what Seattle signified, what happened there, and you were at the 10-year, if you will, anniversary, the next attempt by these international corporate killers to control the resources. Talk about what this anniversary.
Well, definitely, I think while we know that the struggle against corporate power and colonization is more than 500 years old, but Seattle is very important because in the United States, the protest that brought the World Trade Organization down was homemade. It was made in the United States while farmers and people from around the world came to Seattle, but the trade unionists marched with the students and teachers and media saying enough to global corporatization. That was 10 years ago. And since then, World Trade Organization has not been able to move forward with its agenda. The only time it was able to was in its ministerial in Qatar in 2001 following the 9/11 attacks. The threat then was, you are with us or against us, even in trade if you didn't agree. But since then, their efforts to promote Doha Round have collapsed, whether it was in Cancun, whether it was in Hong Kong. And on the 10th anniversary, the WTO actually had the audacity to hold its ministerial, which it had not done, though it is supposed to do it every 2 years. Right. It had not met since 2005. But to avoid another big failure, they called it that it was not a negotiating a ministerial. It was just a conference. But what was really interesting is Pascal Lamy, its director general. I had the opportunity to ask him that, isn't it because we have, you know, the world blames World Trade Organization, this free trade responsible for a financial and food crisis, that, you know, you're having this conference instead of trying to close the deal. And his response was, oh, really? I had never heard that. I have not heard that people are saying that the way we do trade, this unregulated trade, is responsible for the financial crisis. So it really shows how clueless and how out of touch of the reality these people are. I think we are at a very important point, however. We are at a point where Pascal Lamy will try to put pressure. There will be a lot of pressure on developing countries to move ahead with the trade agenda to conclude the Doha round. But I also believe that we have a very important opportunity now to kill it like we killed the free trade area of the Americas. We know 10 years later that World Trade Organization is nothing else but the World Theft Organization. This is a body through which the sovereign power of nations, of communities, the ability of our lawmakers to make laws that protect us, workers, environment, are taken away. We don't need any more evidence. 10 years later, we have it all. We are living in the midst of one of the worst financial crises. We have over a billion people around the world starving. We have a situation where our food system has gone upside down and backwards because our local food production is being replaced by, you know, this global food production, which is destroying our environment, which is destroying our farming communities, which is destroying everything that is sacred. So this is an opportunity for us to do away with this institution. And what was very interesting, Dennis, was that almost all developing countries felt the need to say, yes, we have to conclude the Doha round. But it has to ensure that it protects livelihoods of our people. And I think we have to continue to support developing countries in their concerns and their demand to ensure livelihoods of the people and the environment.
Let me ask you this sort of controversial question. You know, sort of the Western middle class environmentalists, are they getting it? What's the, you know, you represent both in your connection to India and Africa, those who are already dying from these kinds of trade policies and this kind of food and the chemical production. What's that dialogue now? Because I know there is space between.
Well, you know, there is space between. It is very true. Let's take the case of land grabs, for instance. You know, a lot of northern-based organizations, including governmental bodies such as the FAO and IFAD, have come out to say, well, this is a real concern. Land is being taken away, but we can make it a win-win situation. And for us, this win-win situation is a code of conduct that the rich nations come up with. We don't know what the input of the host countries is, if there's any input from the impacted communities, if there are any plans for resettlement of people and compensation for resettlement. More important, who monitors it, how it is implemented. But everyone's talking about a win-win scenario. But if you talk to the people on the ground, whose homes are being destroyed. The land they have worked on for centuries, places like Papua New Guinea where people had communal right to land, all of that is being destroyed. If you speak to them, if you talk to them, if you actually have relationship with them, they're very clear. Their land is not for sale. Their land is not for lease. So there is that divide. Where do we go from here? Personally, I always remember when I'm in the midst of a dilemma like this, I think of this African saying where I think it was a chief from Nigeria who said, if you will not share your wealth with us, we will share our poverty with you.
We're delighted to have with us back from Port-au-Prince, Haiti, Kevin Pina. Kevin Pina has been part of a delegation, leading a delegation, really, as a part of the Latin American Solidarity Coalition of the United States, and part of their statement,
and Canada,
they're saying that our delegation came to investigate human rights violations, and in particular violations by the United Nations, Mustafa Forces. We will send a report of our delegation's findings to the United Nations, to the United States Congress, to President Barack Obama, to the Canadian government, and to Prime Minister Stephen Harper. We will also circulate our findings to the media in our respective countries. Kevin, you were part of the leader of that delegation. Say a little bit more about what happened there, why they came.
Well, it was myself and Dale Sorensen, the Marine Interfaith Task Force, which is part of the Latin American Solidarity Coalition. It was really like six different organizations, and then our friends in the Canadian Haiti Action Network, who were also part of it. All told, there were 13 of us, and we traveled throughout the capital. We went to Cité Soleil, we went to Bel Air, and we met with victims, people who were shot by UN forces, people who were survivors of the July 6, 2005 massacre, who were survivors of the December 22, 2006 massacre committed by UN forces. Incredible testimony. One of the problems that people told us, people who had already been operated on, when the bullets were taken...
So this is the delegation interviewing...
Interviewing victims of UN forces in Haiti. And some of them describing how when they went to Doctors Without Borders, the bullets were taken out and the UN would come in and take the bullets.
No.
Yes. Absolutely. They would take the evidence.
They would collect the bullets.
They would collect the bullets from the hospital and from their victims. But, however, what we also found were there were a great many people that Doctors Without Borders decided not to remove the bullets and are still walking around with the bullets inside of them, which someday, if we can figure out a way to get a forensic surgical team down there, we might still have access to some of that immediate evidence against the United Nations. I mean, that testimony was amazing. More importantly...
Well, just say a little bit more about the kinds of people. How did you find these, identify these people, and say a little bit more about who they were?
Well, I mean, I would go into those neighborhoods and I would look for them. People would remember me because, you know, I spent a couple of years in those neighborhoods documenting, being the only journalist documenting those demonstrations and being there many times when MINUSTAH did open fire on the crowd, or they PNH, the Haitian police, would open fire on the crowds. And I went in and with my Creole was able to ask people, well, find us the people that I remember, and had remembered some of their names, and they found them. I remembered this one 28-year-old man who's paralyzed from the waist down. The bullet couldn't be removed because it's so close to the spine. Medicine on Frontier says they're not prepared to do it. Who can no longer walk. He sits in this one-room shack all day long, doing nothing but thinking about, what if I could walk again? There were victims who came on crutches. There were victims who were brought...
These are people shot by the United Nations.
Shot by the United Nations, who are still there, who are still crippled by the actions of the UN, by UN bullets. Still there, their testimony still capable of being taken, their voices still willing to be heard, but they're also tired. Many delegations have come and have taken this testimony before, but they also understood it's important to keep the pressure on, that we have to keep doing it. We have to keep them in the public's eye outside of Haiti so that people can remain aware that this has gone on. They were very positive at the end of it. They were very encouraged. I wish that there were other ways that we could help them, but you know, we had to do this as objectively as we could.
It's an amazing story. It's been a long road and a long journey for you, and a story that a lot of people have a great deal of difficulty accepting and believing, because everybody sees the United Nations and the Blue Helmets as peacekeepers, as people who have come to their country to help get them back on track, to smooth out whatever happened through wars or insurrection or whatever. And they become the oppressor. The United Nations becomes the oppressor, and in a extraordinarily poor nation like Haiti.
Well, and it's also, it goes beyond. I mean, there's the victims, of course, which are so just salient, and they're amazing. Their spirit, I mean, literally hobbling with a leg that's been shredded by 16-millimeter gunfire, or a leg that's been blown off by a 50-millimeter, which is a big bullet.
Right.
On crutches, coming to us to give us his testimony, us finding little hovels and places where people would put us to the side just in case a MINUSTAH truck came by, which several did, with their guns pulled again in that neighborhood. People telling us that it was just days before we got there that the UN had been firing again in the neighborhood and that they felt terrorized in their own community. And then, of course, there's the other side of what the UN is doing, which is the economic aspect. I don't remember, maybe somebody can correct me, where the UN has ever been this forceful a cheerleader for neoliberal economic policies. Paul Collier comparing Haiti to Mauritius and telling us that creating 50,000 jobs at $3 a day over 10 years is going to solve Haiti's problems. I spoke to an economic development expert who, I'm not going to use his name, but said to me, you know what? I said, do you really think that's going to solve the problem? He said, you know what? It's worse than that. They can't even really get that together.
So they can't even do that?
They can't even do that. We're talking about 4 million adults employed at an age of employment. 80% of them work in the informal economy. They buy and sell little things that they can to get by to make money, but are officially unemployed. 80% of 4 million. We're talking about 50,000 jobs that pay $3 a day. And let me tell you, I could not believe the prices in that country. It's expensive to live. That was sad. That was sad. I don't know how to reconcile what the UN is trying to tell us is going on there, what Bill Clinton is trying to tell us is going on there, and what the Obama administration is trying to tell us is going on there, and Hillary Clinton. They're painting it as a rosy picture, and after, I keep using the figure $7 billion of international aid investment by the international community. When I make that figure, I'm also including what it's cost to maintain those peacekeeping forces in Haiti. The roads were not paved, Dennis. The only road that I saw that was new was the road for the wealthy elite in Pétionville to be able to drive down to their factories that they're building in the flatlands of Cité Soleil and in the old downtown section of Port-au-Prince. The best road in Port-au-Prince is that road, the Pan-American Road. Everything else, nothing was changed. Still only 5 hours of electricity in the capital. And everywhere you go, people are still hungry. They are hungry. And now the UN tells us that they're going to go ahead and back the Preval administration in its political efforts to maintain this system, to keep the Fami Lavalas party out of the electoral process. And by the way, you know where a lot of that money, I can see where a lot of that money was being spent. Preval has created a system of political patronage that the likes of which I've never seen in that country. And it's about buying off layer after layer of Lavalas grassroots leaders in order to bring them into his camp, in order to silence them, and in order to stop them from reflecting the voice of the base, which everywhere I went and I spoke to the common folks in the streets, and I did a lot of that, there were several messages that were very clear. And they repeated over and over again. One, Aristide needs to return. Two, we don't believe in this electoral farce that's coming up. And three, we're being forced to suffer. we're still suffering from that coup of February 29, 2004. And our voices are not being heard by our own government, which is being supported by your government. I heard it over and over and over again.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is your daily investigative news magazine. My name is Dennis Bernstein. By the way, if you missed any of this interview or some of the other interviews with Catherine or that you heard this week, you can go to flashpoints.net and check it out. We will continue to give you information there. Best place to listen to Flashpoints if you want to listen on the archives. Kevin, the delegation, how many people were in the delegation, and how would you read their responses?
I think that they were overwhelmed. I mean, I really put them through their paces. They met with 71 people over a period of 7 days, and they met with representatives of over 40 grassroots organizations from different sectors, from labor to students to market vendors, every sector imaginable, union workers. It was, I think, a bit overwhelming for them. But all of this culminated in a press conference, which myself and Mario Joseph of Bureau Avocat International, who works with the Institute for Justice and Democracy, Brian Concannon's organization outside of Haiti, Mario Joseph and I organized a press conference the last day before I left, and we got 5 major television stations and 13 major radio stations in the capital to come hear them read their statement and for them to answer questions. It had a tremendous impact. And more importantly, what the real impact was is that those people that I told you about, who are the mass of the people that I feel this pulse of now, I think that what I heard from them was, thank you. Thank you. Somebody, we can't speak for ourselves. Our voice has been taken away. But thank you. Thank you for speaking. Thank you for representing that we're hungry. Thank you for representing that we don't feel as if we have political freedom of expression right now. Thank you for representing the victims of the UN that have been covered up for us. I mean, you could really feel that they felt encouraged by the fact that this delegation took such a strong stance on their behalf.
And they go back and they tell the various countries that they're from what happened. They file a report. They're going to, I guess, give this to Congress. Any change in the Obama administration, or is it just status quo?
Yeah, I think it's pretty much status quo. I mean, the other thing that just amazed me was you've got to see this new $75 million U.S. Embassy compound in Haiti. This thing is Fortress America. It's a mini city. It's like 8 city blocks, New York blocks, Dennis, not Oakland blocks. Large. It is huge. And across the street is housing, security housing for embassy staff. Remember, it's not just the U.S. Embassy. They're all in one compound. USAID, NED, you know, they're all.
This is a regional center for the United States national security state.
I don't know how else to describe it. I mean, it's huge. I can't see that in such a poor country. Although, if we think about how close Haiti really is to Venezuela and how close it is to Cuba, maybe it might make a little more sense. Makes me a little bit worried that Hugo Chavez and Venezuela are building and expanding the airfield in Cap Haitien, Haiti's second largest city, and remembering Grenada, yeah. It makes me a little...
Right, when they invaded the island that was about the size of a whale.
It makes me a little nervous of Venezuela supporting building an international airport in the north, which is even closer
to Venezuela.
With dangerous Cuban
terrorists who happen to be doctors.
Oh, my God.
Well, that's worrisome. And obviously, this is really answers a very big question for people, because they're always asking, you know, Kevin, why would the mighty and powerful United States of America give a damn about this little peanut, or if they have some guy named Aristide that they elect with 70% of the population? What can this little country do? Well, it can set an example, and two, if it had a situation like that, it might be harder to use it as an outpost.
Also, you know, there's billions at stake here. There are billionaires in Haiti right now. They're the same ones who were behind the coup. And they're being partnered with George Soros, the Mervs family with George Soros, Andy Apped with Gildan Activewear, the Canadian company. And then you've got Gilbert Bigeaud being partnered up with the Irish telecommunications giant Digicel, right? These are the same families that were behind the coup. And they're being rewarded in this new economic development policy, putting them together as the sort of the foundation. And then on top of that, you put sweatshop after sweatshop after sweatshop.
Are
you
Disney
pay people $3
still doing
a day.
That? It's
Gildan Activewear. Now the Canadians are in there. They're now Brazilian apparel manufacturers.
The Brazilians
are
also the UN force.
The head of the United Nations force, the military force. The largest force inside of the United Nations, so-called peacekeeping force in Haiti, are the Brazilians. They're at the top of the command structure. There are now Brazilian apparel manufacturers who are building factories there as well to take advantage of that $3 a day labor. It's amazing to me because this is the same elite that time and time again has been behind the various coup d'etats, successive coup d'etats in Haiti, and the way that they've done business isn't going to change. And that's why this strategy won't work. If you don't limit the amount of money that they can ship offshore and put in U.S. bank accounts and keep in U.S. dollars, if you don't limit that, if you don't break their monopolies on importation of rice and beans, basic food staples, nothing is going to change. And they're not touching that at all. Quite the contrary. That's remaining intact, and that's the foundation that the United Nations and development experts like experts like Paul Collier and development experts in USAID and in Hillary Clinton in the State Department, that's what they're pushing right now, is that style of economic development. It can't sustain itself, though, because I don't care what anybody says. 50,000 jobs in 10 years at $3 a day will not solve the problems of the Haitian people.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We continue our coverage of the protests going on in Cairo and the attempts to get life and death aid to the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip 1 year after the Israeli-U.S. slaughter there. This morning, what's known as the Viva Palestina convoy, led by British MP George Galloway, was set upon by Egyptian riot police opening up with water cannons and attempting to hobble and undermine the convoy. There were protests, and we believe several people were actually wounded, but our understanding is that the convoy actually made it into Gaza. Joining us now from Amman, Jordan, is Sam Husseini. Husseini is the director of the Institute for Public Accuracy in Washington, D.C. Husseini has been in Cairo over the last 10 days for the Gaza Freedom March and the signing of the Cairo Declaration to end Israeli apartheid in Palestine. Sam Husseini, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Great to be with you, Dennis.
It's good to have you with us again. First of all, what can you tell us about what happened on that convoy? Apparently, the Egyptians did not want to make it easy for the Viva Palestina to get in.
It's kind of mystifying what the conduct of the Egyptians all around. They did everything in their power, seemingly, to prevent Viva Palestina from getting in. They were in Aqaba in Jordan, and they were trying to get in through, overseas. And then they forced them to go all around through Syria, I believe into Turkey, and then to come in through the port of Al-Arish on the Sinai. And then they cornered them off and sprayed water cannons on them and demonized them in the Egyptian media and so on and so forth. And then finally, after all the ruckus, they let them in. It's just kind of mystifying. If anything, they sort of drawn attention to the fact that Egypt has been so complicit with Israel and the United States in their siege of Gaza. Similarly, with the people who were in Cairo with the Gaza Freedom March, that's where I was, a separate effort, but, very much related in spirit of trying to get in. There were 1,300 people, and they could have just simply let the people into Gaza, but they didn't do that. They created numerous obstacles, compelling us to protest on the streets of Cairo, and at that point, beating, kicking, dragging, punching, pulling of the hair of the women, and so on and so forth. at peaceful protesters by plainclothes Egyptian government forces. This happened on New Year's Eve. And it's just, you know, they were able to do a fair amount of effective media blockout of that. But nonetheless, it has had the net effect of having people realize even more greatly the complicity, more than complicity, really, the total cooperation of the Egyptian dictatorship in the Israeli siege of Gaza.
It was pretty interesting that Netanyahu ends up in Cairo. He didn't have any problem getting in or getting out. and he's meeting with the leadership in Cairo. And meanwhile, these 1,300 to 1,400 people are being held. Some of them actually sort of kept prisoner in the hotels, massive security forces. Just talk a little bit about the real politics here. People are confused. Israel is very good at confusing people, at misusing the media. Help us understand the context and why they would take such violent action against the convoy for human aid or this march.
Well, I mean, some of the pro-democracy activists that I met with in Egypt, their thinking was that Mubarak feels that he needs Israeli and U.S. support to consolidate his power and to ensure that his son succeeds him as president, and therefore he's willing to do anything and everything in order to make that happen. And part of the price of that is just totally sealing off Gaza, even to totally peaceful marches like the Gaza Freedom March and the Viva Palestina effort. So it's just an astonishing effort by the Egyptian government, and it really laid bare the elite in Egypt are so disjointed from the general public in Egypt. The massive state security apparatus that has been set up in Egypt over the last 20 years under Mubarak, it's swelled by tenfold. Meanwhile, the regular army has shrunk by two-thirds. So it's become clear that the enemy, as far as the Mubarak government is concerned, is a domestic enemy and anyone who's really fighting for democracy in the Middle East. So we would really have to take you really have to reconsider how you frame the whole subject. It's not so much an Israeli-Arab conflict as it is a conflict between a colonial effort by Israel in collusion but with many Arab states like Egypt against much of the population of the region.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, we're speaking with Sam Hussein. He's the director of the Institute for Public Accuracy in Washington, D.C. He has been in Cairo now in Amman, Jordan over the last 10 days watching these protests unfold. We've done fairly extensive reporting from Cairo with Ali Abunima and the Holocaust, the Jewish Holocaust survivor, Hedy Epstein. So people got a sense of the flavor and the confrontation. But I'd like to ask you to take a look back at the week, maybe talk about highlights and what you think was most significant about the gathering.
Well, one of the most significant things was the way the French contingent conducted themselves. I was kind of ashamed to be part of the American contingent for a while. At one point, some 30 of us had a standoff at the U.S. Embassy. We were confined for about 4 hours. The Egyptian authorities automatically pin you into this little area so that the public passing by doesn't know what's going on. It's clearly their design as to how they do that. The French, I have to really tip my hat to them. The first, right at the beginning of the march, when it became evident that the Egyptians were going to try to block us from going in, they immediately took to the streets in front of the French embassy, demanding that the French embassy intercede to allow them free passage. They took over the street there. They were penned in front of their embassy, and they held vigil there and slept in there for the better part of a week. Meanwhile, nothing like that happened on the U.S. side, and I think that, you know, the U.S. organizers bear some scrutiny in that. I think that the French effort was a major highlight. The march on New Year's Eve of in Tahrir Square, which is right near the Egyptian museum, is like, you know, the biggest, it's like Times Square, basically, in New York City. It's the biggest area. There was an attempted march there, and that's where most of the violence happened, kicking, punching, dragging by the plainclothes Egyptian forces. People can find video of that via my website, Husseini.org, and I assume elsewhere. So those were some of the major highlights, and eventually, even though the Egyptian government tried to prevent it, we were able to meet with and coordinate with many of the pro-democracy Egyptian activists, and to really help lay bare the complicity between the Egyptian government and the Israeli government in the siege of Gaza and much else. For example, many people joined forces with a lawsuit that's going on in Egypt to try to prevent the steel wall that Egypt is having built and to open the border. It's being done by the same lawyer, Ibrahim Yusri, in Egypt, who has launched a lawsuit which the Egyptian government has illegally, continually delayed to try to prevent Egypt from selling its natural gas to Israel at below market costs. Clearly, there's an incredibly high degree of corruption in Egypt, massive payoffs and so on, and partially in collusion with the Israeli government. I should also say, Dennis, in terms of things going on at Flashpoints, part of the reason that I decided to go on this trip was that there were so many other strong activists like Aliyah Benima and Nora. I was expecting to be on this trip as well, and I was very sad that she wasn't able to because of the situation over there in Flashpoints. And I really hope that people look at that and scrutinize the situation. I think that Flashpoints' coverage of crucial issues like the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and things that are not convenient to look at times, but desperately need to be looked at in an extremely critical way. I hope that people galvanize around that as forcefully as possible in order to make sure that that continues. It's not going to continue if people don't galvanize around that. If anything, I learned that in the streets of Cairo.
Well, thanks, Sam Husseini. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is your daily investigative news magazine, and you're referring to Nora Barros-Friedman, who has been our lead reporter over the last 6 years in covering the illegal occupation and ethnic cleansing of Palestine. Nora has been shot at and has, I like to say, learned Arabic so that she could hear the story in the language of the people who are living it. So she has been an invaluable source. We did have to keep her back. She did want to go and join you all. But we're doing everything in our power to make sure that she can return in February to do some more reporting. And we were pleased that Nora and myself and the Flashpoints team was, in fact, singled out by Pulse to be among the top 20 global media figures. It's a little humbling, but it comes at a good time because people, as you know, Sam, do not like the story, and they do everything they can to wipe it out. In the U.S., I was shocked to hear from Hedy Epstein that we were the only U.S. media, electronic media, to cover her and to do this dialogue with her. So we were delighted about that. Speaking about her, but in particular about the document that was prepared by the South African contingent that calls for the end of Israeli apartheid and supports a divestment campaign. That was certainly a significant culmination. She was the first signer, but hundreds have signed it now. What do you see as the significance of that?
I definitely see that as a very significant part of this. And that really seems to be the main organizational framework that's going to come out of this, because there was a crisis of leadership in terms of the march and so on. What's being called the Cairo Declaration. I believe it's on the internet. People can do a search on Cairo Declaration, I believe, and it's a very comprehensive document in terms of boycott, divestment, sanctions against Israel. I believe that there are going to be protests in front of Israeli embassies and consulates, I believe, on the 16th of January. You might know better than I, Dennis. Coming out of that, and it's going to be hopefully a comprehensive global movement towards scrutinizing Israel. It'll include tours by South African activists with Palestinian activists in the United States and elsewhere in order to draw the parallels vis-a-vis Israeli apartheid and so on, and I think it was simply a magnificent stroke by the South African delegation to take the lead on that issue.
Yes, and very poignant that indeed it does come out of a delegation that knows a great deal about the implications and the impact and the suffering that can take place under white supremacy, under this kind of government in which certain people have rights and a bunch of others don't. So finally, Sam Husseini, back to the media. Talk a little bit about the struggle to get this story out in the U.S. media. That's part of what you do every day.
Yeah, it's just astonishing to me. I mean, imagine, you know, hundreds of U.S. and other internationals being beaten on the streets of Tehran and what the coverage of that would be like if that were done by Iranian forces, if they had, you know, beaten and punched and dragged American activists. It would be nonstop on CNN. You know, the entire media structure would come to a halt and say, look, my God, look at what the savage Iranians are doing and so on. But it's the favorite regime of Hosni Mubarak. You know, great client state of the United States, the second recipient of U.S. aid after Israel. And, you know, from what I've been able to see, I've spent the last 10 days on the streets of Cairo trying to organize and meet with Egyptian activists. But from everything that I've been able to see, there's very virtually minimal, totally minimal coverage in the U.S. And I should say that there's even minimal coverage, or surprisingly little coverage, at least on many of the Arab satellite stations. There's a fair amount of coverage of the Viva Palestina, George Galloway effort, but that was always confined to small ports like Aqaba and Al Arish, whereas we were in Cairo, the cultural and population center of the Arab world. And there was minimal coverage of it, and I think that that had the net effect of preventing, you know, or at least hindering solidarity from ordinary Egyptians with the 1,300 internationals who were there. So I believe that even the Al Jazeeras and so on took something of a dive here and should have provided much more coverage of the of the march in Cairo, and certainly when it turned violent, or particularly violent on New Year's Eve.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. You will not be hearing the night report tonight because of severe budget cuts on the Flashpoints team. We miss Robert Knight. We miss his reporting, particularly now on Oman and various other aspects of what's going on around the world. We hope that that will be remedied soon. Coming up now, Catherine Austin Fitz, and community business returns to Flashpoints. Catherine, welcome back.
Hi, Dennis.
Good to have you with us. And I guess we could say, as we get ready to review the year that has just passed, squid crime pays. I want to read a little bit of the article you wrote that's up on your website now. And, of course, you opened it up with this marvelous quote from Matt Taibbi from Inside the Great American Bubble Machine, in which he's talking about Goldman Sachs. And he says about them, and I quote, "The world's most powerful investment bank is a great vampire squid wrapped around the face of humanity, relentlessly jamming its blood funnel into anything that smells like money. Interesting. Let me just read a little bit here.
Okay.
What you write. For years, it was hard for many of us to fathom the psychopathic nature of our financial elites or to expand the meaning of Matt Taibbi's marvelous description of Goldman Sachs. You just heard that. The Great Vampire Squid. Squid seems a fitting name for the financial cartel that drives what I have traditionally called the tapeworm. All right, tell us a little bit about the squid and the tapeworm and how it defined last year economically.
Well, the tapeworm is my nickname for the military-industrial complex. It's basically, it's a group of people operating on a model that operates a little bit like a tapeworm in your body. It's a parasite. It injects into you a chemical that makes you crave what's good for the tapeworm and bad for you. And so literally we have the outsiders supporting, honoring, feeding, financing the very parasite that's killing them. And when Matt came up with the expression, the great vampire squid, I just thought it was so fabulous that... and it's such a perfect description of the financial part, because what we saw in 2009, Dennis, was the financial cartel literally blossom in its arrogance. We'd watched them shift incredible amounts of money out of this country over the last 10 to 15 years, often by what I would say is criminal means. We saw the housing bubble as the fraudulent inducement in America. We saw, as you and I discussed in the European Union lawsuit against RJR, massive money laundering by big corporations owned by big leveraged bio firms. So, we watched decades of criminality coming into 2008, when in fact, after selling all this fraudulent paper around the world, and everybody assuming, we all know it's trading sardines, not eating sardines, so figuring the Fed would make them good on it if there was any problem, we saw everybody in the world realize, it's all funny paper, and we might have to take losses on it, we might have to eat it. And then literally the U.S. government turning around and bailing them out. I said in the article that Bloomberg had announced that gold was the best performing investment of the decade, and I took disagreement with Bloomberg. I said the best performing investment of the decade was the $1 billion spent to, for the squid to elect Barack Obama president, because literally in a year, he managed to put $12 trillion into the squid's pocket. And this is astonishing. So you spend $1 billion, you get $12 trillion. A lot of it came in the form of literally gifts, and some of it came in the form of loans. And then the Fed and Treasury allowed incredible speculative sort of rigged behavior by the squid. And so the squid then gets to pay money back. Now, literally, if you looked at the financial mechanisms that were used to engineer those profits, you and I could have used those very same mechanisms to engineer massive profits for every household and every small business in the country. So there's no performance here. When it's all said and done, we have Wall Street at the end of the year paying themselves huge and hideous bonuses. And so this really was a year where the financial cartel literally went wild in public and basically turned around and said, we don't care. We have the vice chairman of Goldman International turning around and saying, everybody has to get used to a hypocritical system. Get used to it. And so literally, what we've seen is the squid has come all the way out of the closet. And unfortunately, one of the squid's most brilliant moves was, and to me it's probably the most brilliant investment financially of the century, they got a guy elected as president who literally turned the keys over to them.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows-Friedman. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and The Block Report contribute to this program. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.